radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Welcome to the Leader's Toolbox on radio at firehouse.com. My name is Peter Matthews. I'm an editor at Firehouse, and we are here today with host and fire chief Richard Gassaway. Welcome, Chief. I know you had a couple of shows recently that you had attended, and I know you'll be going across the pond, as they say, here in the next few weeks. So what have you been up to? What have you seen? Where have you been?
Yep. Well, thanks, Pete, and thanks for the listeners who continue to give their support to the Leader's Toolbox. I had an opportunity to go to Alaska and spend some time with some new friends that I made at the Alaska Fire Chiefs and Firefighters Association Conference last month, and that was my first trip to the big country, and the folks in Juneau and Chief Mormon were wonderful hosts, and I very much appreciate the hospitality of the Alaska Fire Chiefs and the opportunity to go and spend some time with them talking about leadership. On November 12th and 13th, I will be traveling to London to speak at the 13th Annual Fire Service College Research and Development Symposium at the British Fire Service College, where I'll be talking about fire ground command decision-making and presenting my research. So I'm pretty excited with that opportunity. It's my first chance to travel abroad, and I'm looking forward to making some new friends in the fire service there.
Well, it sounds like a nice trip to Alaska, and I've heard the UK Symposium is a great opportunity to network with folks you don't get to normally see in person and talk with. So we look forward to hearing about that trip when you return. We do have a couple of questions, and again, to any of the listeners, if you do have any comments for the show or any questions for Chief Gassaway, please send us an email. The email address is podcast@firehouse.com. Rich, the first question is, let's see here. I'm the newly hired fire chief in a combination department that operates three paid crews, six firefighters and two captains from four stations. The volunteer firefighters man the fourth station and a second unit in each of the three stations. Because of the volunteer shortage, we have automatic aid from two departments for a structure fire from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. daily. No matter the time of day, we have a third department respond as the rapid intervention company. I've been sitting here at the chief's desk for almost a year now, and we've only had three training sessions with the mutual aid departments, and we probably respond together 5 to 10 times a week. At the regional chief officers meeting, I brought up the idea of more cross-training, but the other chief officers don't feel it's necessary. Can you offer any advice or data that could be used to show the importance of cross-training?
Okay. First, I applaud the chief and the chiefs of that region for identifying the challenges that they're having with staffing and to enter into automatic aid agreements to try to bolster their staffing and to ensure that they get the right number of firefighters on the scene early enough to make a difference, both in the outcome for the victims and the safety of the firefighters. And as well, I applaud them for having the foresight to have a separate response for rapid intervention and to have that crew dedicated to the function of rapid intervention. The first thing that comes to mind when I hear this question is, what is the problem to be fixed? This chief who wrote in has stated that he or she thinks that there is a need to have more training on a regional basis, yet the other chiefs don't necessarily support the concept. So the first question is, what problem needs to be fixed that this chief has identified that there is a need to have more regional training? He doesn't, or he or she doesn't go into detail about whether there's been problems or challenges on the scenes of incidents. They're responding together 5 to 10 times a week. that's a lot of time together. think that they're probably getting a good opportunity to be exposed to each other's operations with that many responses. I would look at it and say, how are the crews working together when they get on the scenes of these incidents? Do they seem to be communicating well and well coordinated? Is the policies and procedures similar enough that they're able to function cohesively? Is the equipment, including the radios, compatible? Are the radio procedures and the dispatches compatible so that they're able to communicate among themselves? Do they have similar terminology about what they're calling things and how they engage in their operations? If things are going relatively well, then I would caution having training sessions just for the sake of saying we train more. Now, with that said, I don't want the listeners to think that I'm not an advocate of training and regional training, because I very much am, as long as it's serving a purpose, as long as there's some benefit to come. Now, someone would argue and say, well, anytime you train, you're going to get better. I don't argue with that. That's kind of like a sports team is saying, anytime you practice, you're going to get better at what you do. And that's true in sports, and it's true in the fire service, that anytime you practice, you are going to get better working as a team. So I won't take away from the fact that more training is always better. With that said, though, if you're trying to introduce training to a regional level and there isn't interest, then you have to gauge what is the problem that needs to be solved. And I think that this chief might do better to, instead of saying to the other chiefs of the region, we need to train more, is to try to assess the operations of what is happening when we respond together. How are we doing? Where are we coming up short? What are some of the areas that we can improve upon? And if you can't identify a tangible list of that, maybe you don't need to do more regional training. You know, they're doing it 3 or 4 times a year. Maybe that's enough just to make sure that everybody's on the same page. But if you're coming up with a list, a pretty good, strong, meaty list of the things that we're not doing so well at when we go to these automatic aid calls, whether it's coordination of the crews or radio procedures or just general policy and procedures, or our equipment doesn't appear to be as compatible as it could be, then you've got some opportunity there, and you build build the argument for regional training based on the observations of how things could be better. I'm guessing that if this chief is advocating for more regional training, that he or she has already identified this need. They don't say that specifically in the question, but I'm going to guess that they have. The purpose of having more training on a regional basis would be to ensure that everybody is on the same page when it comes to operating at the scene of an incident. Now you think of an orchestra. The players, the musicians, do a great deal of practicing independently. They have their piece of sheet music, and they practice it alone until they get pretty good at it. But that's not good enough. They have to then come together with the other members of the orchestra to make sure that what they're playing is in sync and right pitch and right tempo as to what everyone else is playing for the music to sound, for the orchestra, for the concert to sound right. And that's what this regional training does, is, if Department A trains independently and they do it really well, and Department B trains independently and they do it really well, and so does C and so does D, that's good. But when you bring them all together, are they making music? Are you looking at it and say, this is a smooth and cohesive operation? If it isn't, there lies the opportunities that this chief could perhaps enlighten his peers on. Now, different people have different expectations on a scene of a fire, whether it's for their own people or whether it's if they involve mutual aid or automatic aid. In other words, I don't think that perfection is something that is an achievable expectation. We all would like our people to be perfect in every way, at every scene, all the time, 100%. And we strive for that, but I don't know that we ever really achieve it. We might achieve it on one call. We might achieve it on a couple calls. But then something's going to happen where we're going to have a slight aberrancy, a small, hopefully small, mistake or a goof-up or an oversight or something isn't going to work the way that we wanted. So I think what the chiefs of this region have to assess is what is the opportunity for regional training, what is the cost for regional training, and are we going to get incrementally better, is there a need to be incrementally better than what we are now in the way we provide our services? And if there is, let's develop a plan about the areas we need to get better in and use our time very efficiently and effectively to get better at the things that we identify as the most important need based on the experience that they've had. Sometimes departments that enter into automatic and mutual aid agreements, while they're good, might find themselves challenged because different departments have different beliefs and different philosophies about how things should be done. And one of the challenges that I've seen people grapple with is trying to change the culture or philosophy of a neighboring department because that department doesn't operate the way that we do. And if you go into this with the, they're different than us, but the way that we do it is right, and the way that we do it, they do it is wrong, or we do it better and they do it worse, you're kind of setting yourself up for some confrontation. I think the better way would be to try to find the middle ground and say, what things could we change and what things could they change when we're on a mutual aid call or an auto aid call so that we come together and we're still able to operate, but we maintain some of our independence. And the two departments might find that there is enough common ground that they could make some common policies and procedures and each agree to make minor tweaks and adjustments so that when they do come together, they're operating more cohesively as a team instead of as two independent departments that have just, you know, arrived and come together at the scene of emergency and operate independently. For example, you know, one of the things that comes to mind is safety procedures. You know, if one department is pretty strict on safety and the other department is laxed or non-compliant to safety procedures, and one might be the RIT, since he mentioned or she mentioned RIT. You know, if you're a department who says we'll always have a RIT at every structure fire incident, and that's non-negotiable, and you're doing automatic aid with another department who doesn't have RIT, doesn't use it, and doesn't train their people in RIT procedures, then you have a disconnect, because when you go to their community, maybe you serve as RIT, and when they come to your community, they don't understand what RIT is, or they're trained in it, so they're not able to serve as a RIT team. So there you have a disconnect that you're going to have to find some common ground. You're going to have to find a way to work through that so that there's some continuity of the services and the safety of the firefighters, regardless of which community they're operating in. But realize that there are going to be differences in beliefs and philosophies among neighboring communities. I haven't seen two separate independent fire departments who completely align. They all have their different philosophies and beliefs about different things, from operations to safety to you know, what kind of trucks they purchase and how they equip them and what tools are best and what are not. The important thing is to find the common ground. I think it's also important to understand the capabilities and the operations of each participant so that you, when you call a neighboring department, you know what they're capable of and you know what they're not capable of, so that you ask them to do what they're capable of doing and don't set them up for failure by asking them to do something that you know that they're not capable of doing. I was talking to a fire chief once was talking about the several neighboring departments that they do mutual aid with, and he said when we call mutual aid, this department's always our RIT team because they're really on the ball and they train a lot on RIT and they really know RIT. And this department over here, who doesn't see a lot of structure fires and they don't do a lot of training, we always give them water supply because they're pretty good at hitting hydrants and getting lines laid and helping with pump operations. But other than that, they have some limitations. The important thing is that if you're going to work together with your neighbors, that you take some steps to try to understand their capabilities, their procedures, and the way they are going to perform when they come to give you aid. So there's no surprises for you, no surprises for them. You can figure out what their strengths are and use that to your advantage and figure out areas where they're not as strong. And if they're willing to get stronger, certainly help them. But if they're not, then find a way to work around it and use them for what they can offer to you without, compromising your operations, because you sure don't want to ask a neighboring department to do something they're not good at. That's going to set them up for failure. It's going to set your incident up for failure. So understanding their capabilities is pretty important. Clearly, if you're going to practice together, it's going to create a greater understanding between the departments. You're going to have more familiarity between the people and the equipment. You know, you get on a scene and there's somebody from a neighboring department that you were just doing a RIT drill with the week before, you're going to know them not only by name but recognize them and be more comfortable with their abilities when you've seen them perform versus looking at them and saying, I don't even know this person's name. I don't know anything about them. I don't know anything about their abilities. And it's kind of hard to just blindly throw your trust toward working with somebody that you don't know. So it's going to build that kind of rapport. It's also going to create better teamwork and better coordination at the scene of an incident. You know, if you and I have to do something together, at the scene of an emergency is probably not the first and best place for us to practice doing that, when maybe we're only going to get one chance to do it, and we have to do it well because somebody's well-being is at stake if we don't do it well. And I think you, by doing more drills and practicing together, you're going to get more efficient and more effective outcomes. We're just going to be better at what we do, and we're going to be able to do it quicker, and we're going to be able to do it better if we spend some time practicing together. Now, the writer doesn't say why the neighboring departments aren't interested in doing these drills. But one of the reasons might be the cost of having people to come together on a separate drill night, or it just might be an issue of managing people's time and saying, you know, we're busy enough now doing our own drills, throwing another drill in there might just be too time-consuming for our members. So I want to offer a solution that might work in lieu of having these joint drills, if you just can't get them to come together, is to try to get the chiefs of the department of the various departments to agree to allow one or two people from neighboring departments to come to each other's drills. So if I'm having a drill, my neighboring department will send one or two people from their department to come to my drill and learn how my department does things. And we'll learn how their department does things. In other words, those two people are become like pseudo trainers to tell us how they do things. And then our department is smarter about how they operate, and they're able to take the ideas that they pick up at our drill back to their drill and to their people and train them about what they learned by coming to drill at our department. So by doing this mutually, instead of bringing all the people of all the departments together, which has its benefits, but if you're not able to do that, send one or two people to neighboring departments' drills, share how you do it, learn how they do it, and then bring those ideas back home to your department. And at your own drill, say, you know, when we went to the community age drill last month, here's how they did whatever that procedure is. Just, and not to say that it's better or worse, but it's good for your people to know that's how they're going to do it when they come to help out. So that's an alternative to having the larger multi-company drills. Well, they are doing them 3 to 4 times a year, so I would encourage them to identify the areas of greatest opportunity for improvement and coordination and focus those drills on those topics. So that's my advice for the chief.
Rich, one of the things, the buzzword of interoperability in the fire service, and when you hear that, you think communications equipment, incident command, but also the interoperability of equipment. The first department I was a member of in a pretty rural to suburban community in upstate New York, anything at a high-risk structure received an automatic response of between 3 and 4 departments with tankers and all that because of water supply issues. And in those situations there, you had to have apparatus operators who knew how to pump from ponds, from the portable pool ponds and stuff like that. So that was one thing that we had always looked at. And then just the basics in knowing each other's equipment and even the couplings, that's another thing that my last department, we had issues with. Every department around us had a different set of couplings to go to the hydrants. So you had to deal with stretching hose lines from different rigs.
So. Yeah, I've seen a few occasions in the past and departments that I've dealt with where they didn't have compatible water supply couplings from truck to truck, from department to department. And then, inevitably, when you call mutual aid and you can't marry up the hose lines, that's going to be problematic. And it kept coming back and saying, we got this problem. And they'd had this problem for decades. And finally, somebody said, well, why don't we just get adapters to put on all of our inlets and outlets? If you've got, 5-inch supply and it stores, then you get if we all agree that, say, a 4-inch storage is the connection of choice. Okay, so no matter what kind of supply line you have, whether it's screw thread, national standard, whatever, storage, you buy a coupling that makes it end in a 4-inch storage so that it can plug into the side of my truck. And I'll do the same. Even if I've got 5-inch inlets on my truck, I'll get an adapter that will go to a 4-inch storage so that if you supply me, I'm able to receive water from you. And as simple as that sounds, this problem had plagued this area for decades because they all, years ago went their own ways and bought their own stuff, and there was no compatibility. And for whatever reason, it's hard to say that they didn't play well together. Maybe they, bought separate stuff on purpose so they wouldn't be able to. But as time went on and they decided they did want to play more together, they were plagued by this incompatibility of their equipment. And finally somebody said, well, let's just have a regional standard for hose connection. And it took a little while for some of the departments that had, lesser money to be able to afford to buy the connections. It was only a couple connections that they needed, one for the end of the supply line and one for the intake on their truck, and everybody was in business. And then they had compatibility of their supply. And that particular problem went away. So the next big fire that they had, while they might have had other challenges, being able to give and receive water to each other was one challenge that was taken care of. But if you don't spend some time with your neighboring departments, you don't know what they have, so you don't know where these opportunities lie with interoperability. And again, it's not just communications. I think of training when I think of interoperability. Do we train the same way on the same thing to get the same outcome between us and our neighbors? And nobody, I don't think, is going to get a perfect alignment. But what I hope for is a compatible alignment, something that will work so that we're effective in what we're trying to accomplish for the benefit of the customer.
All right. Well, Chief, thank you for the advice, and we'll be back after a quick break here.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Welcome back to the Leader's Toolbox here on radio at firehouse.com. If you do have any questions for Chief Gasway, please send us an email to podcast@firehouse.com, or you can use the comment box at the bottom of the podcast player page. Chief, the second question is, I'm currently the assistant chief of a volunteer fire department and should be elected to the position of chief in the next few months. My biggest concern is the response for alarms after midnight, which the turnout has been decreasing over the last few years. For a typical nuisance alarm, such as a fire alarm activation or wires down, we're lucky to get three people between the two stations. On an EMS call, we may get four or five, and on a car fire crash, we'll get 6 to 7 people. As chief, I respond to the scene, and it's a lonely feeling waiting for the ambulance or engines to arrive. A handful of times, I've had to call mutual aid for an alarm activation or an ambulance. We've looked at overnight duty crews as an option, but haven't nailed down a program yet. We operate on a point-per-call system to stay active and collect the retirement program, and I was thinking of doubling the overnight points to boost the response. Can you help me out with this so I'm not the only one with sleepy eyes on the scene of some responses?
Well, I think that this assistant chief is describing a problem that's perhaps becoming more common in the fire service as departments are getting busier and busier and relying on less and less people to carry that load. The chief here described the problem as something that has come about over the last few years. So I would ask, what's changed over the last few years? Are you busier for calls? Do you have less people? Or is it a combination of both busier for calls and less people? To try to get a handle on what is the root of the challenge here, that there's less and less responders coming to calls. I think that one of the best ways for this assistant chief, soon to be chief, to address this is to involve the members of the department in owning the problem. You know, this isn't the chief's problem or the assistant chief's problem. It's the department's problem. You know, the department's mission, whether they have one written or not, if it's unwritten, is something like to serve and protect the citizens of our community from fires and you know, to provide medical care and whatever it is that their mission is. If they're not responding, they're not fulfilling their mission. And that is something that all the members are responsible for. So I would encourage this officer to have a discussion, whether it's in a meeting or informally, in a, you know, a round table or a discussion after the a call at the tailboard of the truck. But I would try to involve as many members as possible in a discussion about what's the problem. Why are people not coming to calls? Nighttime calls. He doesn't mention challenges with, you know, daytime or weekend calls, but alarms after midnight. So, what is it that is causing some problems for us to when responding to calls after midnight, and get their input on helping to identify the problem? The assistant chief, soon to be chief, might think they know what the problem is, but until they ask the members, they're really not going to know why the people are not responding to calls. I think that one of the things that they might hear is we're having too many nuisance calls after midnight, and I got to get up and go to work the next day, and that makes me tired, as this person knows it makes them tired to get up and go to them too. You know, we're just so busy that it seems like I'm coming in every night, and, you know, and then, you know, I'm tired when it comes to, you know, do things with my kids, you know, so a couple, you know, possible explanations. But again, don't assume that what I'm telling you is the reason. rather you ask them directly to help identify the problem, and then I would ask them to help identify the solution. Again, and I'm going to give you a few pieces of advice here, but more importantly than my advice is to have them come up with their own solution to their problem, because this is their problem. Now, it's their fire department, and they own this problem. You know, when we can't get out the door, we're failing to meet the core mission of our existence. That's a problem for all of us, and we should own this, and we should have enough interest in the success of our organization to come up with a viable solution to this problem, and involve them in the solution. They're more likely to own a solution that they have input in and that they help develop than one that is given to them. For example, this chief mentioned that they might double the points for overnight responses versus responses at other times as a way to incent people to want to respond more. Well, incentives can work, and that can work if people are not responding because they don't think they're getting enough points. In other words, if there are people who'd say, if you'd only give me more points, then I would respond more. Well, then that'll work. You know, that incentive will work. But I'm suspecting that these people aren't responding because they think they're not getting enough points. I think they're not responding for some other reasons, and it just might be that they're feeling tired and stressed from the workload. Another challenge that you have with doubling the points for nighttime responses is surely someone who's day available, maybe they work a nighttime job, so they're not available for the overnight calls at all because they're at work. This person then says, how come somebody who responds to a nighttime call gets more points than I do for a daytime call? I work overnight, so I'm sleeping in the daytime. Essentially, that's my nighttime. So while I'm sleeping in the daytime and I have to get up and go to a call, I earn half the points of somebody who's doing the same thing that I'm doing. They're just doing it at night instead of doing it during the day because I have a nighttime job. That's not fair. Or somebody might say, they don't take any more risk at night with their lives than I take in the daytime with my life responding to a call. Why should they earn more points than I get? Because we're equally taking the same risk. And in fact, I might argue that I go to more calls during the daytime because maybe we're busier in the daytime and I have to get up more often in the daytime than they do at nighttime, yet they're earning double points. So it could have an adverse effect to just offer an incentive without consideration for the consequences. And again, as always, I like to offer up some potential solutions, but I would encourage you to get the fingerprints of your members on these solutions. You know, find a way to help what I'm about to give you as advice become their ideas. You know, maybe just plant a seed and let them cultivate it into an idea that they can own and put their own touches on. But one of the things that you could do is you could set up an on-call schedule. And I know some departments who have done this who get busier at nighttime, especially with alarm calls and alarm resets. And maybe if they're doing medicals, helping people who've fallen and need help to get back up. And if you're toning out the entire department for a call that you only need 3 or 4 or 5 people for, and everybody comes in, but you only need 3 or 4, and then everybody has to, you know, sign the book and go back home, pretty soon they're going to realize there's not much reason for me to come in. They don't need all this help. So then they start to justify in their own excuses for not coming in, saying, well, they don't need me anyhow. It's just an alarm reset at the XYZ company that we go to five times a week, and chances are it's just another alarm reset, and we, you know, we bring in 25 people and four go out and reset the alarm, and, you know, and then all of us are tired and cranky, and you know, and we've just been doing too much of that, so I just won't come in for that kind of call. So one of the things that you could do is you could set up kind of like a tiered response where you have some people on call. Say, for example, on Monday night, you have a certain five people that are on call for Monday night. So that if there's anything short of a structure fire or a car wreck with entrapment or something where you need a whole lot of resources, then when you set the pager off, only those five people have to get up and respond. And I know some departments that have even gone as far as to put you know, special tones in a pager and then have on-call pagers available at the station so that if you're on call, you come and pick up a certain pager for the night that you're on call so that you'll get alerted for the on-call alarms, but you don't get alerted if you're not on call. Where some pagers have like an A setting, a B setting, a C setting on them, and they make like the B setting, you know, for if you're, if it's your night on call, you set it to B setting. So if the dispatch puts out the tone for just the on call crew, then you're the only one that gets woke up. And if your pager's set on A, you don't get woke up for that call. Then you can work the details out about how to make that work. But the essence of it is that you have a smaller number of people that are on call to answer the less than all hands working, all hands needed type incident. And if you have enough people, maybe you only have to be on call once a week or at worst twice a week. And everyone takes their turn of their obligation to come in for these smaller type calls, and you're not having to tone the whole department, and everyone has then their obligation, their time that they're responsible for. And that sometimes is enough that if a person is laying in bed and they say, and you tone the whole department, they say, well, somebody else will get up and go in and reset that alarm. I'm taking tonight off. Where if this person is on call and they know they have to get up, they're going to have a greater sense of obligation to say, you know what, no one else is going to get up and go in because this is my night to have to do that. This is my obligation. I have to get up and go in and be part of that crew to reset that alarm. And I think that your people will better appreciate that you're managing their time by saying, you know what, if we have these smaller alarms, we're not going to tone the whole department and bring everybody in. It's kind of a waste of their time, and it's going to impact them if they're getting up during the night doing this often. Another thing is to look at ways to reduce the number of nuisance alarms. You know, if you're going to the same company time and time again for alarm resets, it's time to meet with the management of that company and say, you know, you're killing us here. We keep coming back for alarms because you have a problem, and you need to get that problem fixed because you're going to impact the fire department such that we're not going to have anybody respond to alarms to your business. We're almost there now where nobody wants to respond to an alarm here at your business. You've cried wolf so many times that when you have that real incident, we're not going to have people show up because they're just going to assume that it's a false alarm, and that's a dangerous, dangerous position to be in. And you need to get your alarm system fixed so that when it's going off for a legitimate reason. Some places put into place fees and penalties for alarms. For companies whose alarms are continually going off as a nuisance, and, you know, not for legitimate purposes, and when you start to fine them, then they tend to pay attention and get the problem fixed. And you might have to go to that, or it might just be enough to talk to them and plead to their reason of, you know, if you really have a fire, we want to be here for you. But the number of nuisance alarms are making our people roll over at 2 o'clock in the morning and saying, I'm just not going to go in for that another false alarm. And then one of these times it's going to be something, and then you're going to wonder, where's the fire department? And they're all going to be home in bed because they're sick and tired of coming to your false alarms. And you know, hopefully somebody who's you know, cares about their business is going to be able to relate to how that is a problem for the department. So one of the solutions is you can set up an on-call program where people are on call, and anything short of a major call, only the on-call people come in, and it gives everyone else then a night off from responding. You know, they know that if their pager goes off, it's only going to be for an all-hands-working or reported all-hands-working type thing, like a structure fire or car wreck with entrapment or something like that. Again, if you double the points, you might not fix the problem. If the problem is burnout, I don't know that double points is going to fix it. I don't know that triple points are going to fix it. And let's just say double points does fix it, but the problem is burnout. You know, how long at double points before they feel burned out again? And just say, you know, double points just aren't enough because I'm still, you know, being impacted and tired from this. The assistant chief here had mentioned an overnight duty crew, and that certainly is an option. But you have to consider, you know, the potential impact of that, of people being away from their families and being away from their comfortable bed, and you know, being there to tuck their kids into bed at night. You know, all of those things have value and importance to people. If you have enough members who live close enough to the station that they could stay at home versus having to come in and be on duty at the station, then you could probably do it with an on-call program. If your people live further away, then you might have to have an on-duty program, or you have a duty crew that is in the station. If you have a duty crew that's in the station, I would assess your policies to make sure that they're handling most of the calls, you know, with a few exceptions of those calls that need more help. You know, your duty crew ought to be able to handle most of the calls. And I know there'll be somebody out there that says, you know, every fire alarm could be a fire. Yeah, it could be. I'm not going to, you know, deny you that. But my experience also says that most fire alarms aren't fires. And if there is fires, you know, you'll get, a call from the premise, or you'll get like a sprinkler head activation call from the alarm company, which is a, you know, better indicator that there might be a fire than just the general fire alarm. So it's a risk versus reward proposition for a department to choose to send one company to fire alarms. But if you find that that's all you're sending now because no one's showing up, then you're not doing anything different. You know, if you're kidding yourself, if you say, well, you know, a fire alarm could be a fire and we need everybody. Well, that's great if you tone everybody, but only four show up, you're not doing anything more than sending a single fire company anyhow. So if that's what you're doing, then consider only by design sending a single fire company to investigate the alarm, and you know, that's all you're getting anyhow when you tone the whole department. I think that this particular individual is on a dangerous course to crashing themselves. You know, they talk about being, sleepy-eyed in the middle of the night because they're the only ones who show up, and how lonely it is, and it sounds to me like they're trying to carry a heavy load to make the department successful, but they're doing it alone, as if they're the only ones who have ownership in the problem, and they're the only ones responsible for seeing that the department continues to carry through its mission. And this, you know, serving the community in fire and emergency services is not a solo gig. It's a team thing. And for this person to try to carry the load all themselves, I think is unfair. I think they're setting themselves up to burn out. I think they're setting themselves up to have family problems. I think they're setting themselves up to have problems with their employer, who's going to get frustrated with their lower work productivity because they're always coming in tired. And I think it has the potential to impact the health of this person, too. So I think they need to get some ownership among their members into the problem and get their members engaged in what is the solution, what can we do as a department to try to fix the problem. And again, I kind of went on the assumption that the problem was excessive workload. There could be other issues. There could be people are despondent because the department isn't training enough, or the department's equipment isn't up to their desired satisfaction. You know, until you flesh it out to say what's the problem, you don't really know. I tended to lean toward burnout because he described it as a problem that happens between, you know, midnight and morning. You know when people are you know, value their sleep and getting up and going in is you know, it's going to take away from that and make them tired the next day. I mean, given a choice, I think everybody'd like to have a good night's sleep. But when you buy on to being on the fire department, you also buy into the obligation of being a responder and answering emergency calls. But our job is the chiefs and administrators of the department is to make sure that we're using our members' time efficiently and effectively, and that when we call them in, we really need them. And if we don't really need them, don't call everyone in. I think those days have come to pass because we're just too busy now as emergency providers to bring everybody in for every call. We don't need them, so don't do it. So that's my advice for them.
All right, Chief. Well, thank you very much again for the input and the advice. If you do have any questions for Chief Gassoy for the Leaders Toolbox podcast, please send us an email. The email address is podcast@firehouse.com. Or you can leave any comments, suggestions, or questions at the bottom of the podcast player page, which is right at the bottom. Rich, we'll actually, I just got word, too, that you'll have an article in the November issue of the magazine. So this podcast will be coming out in November. Take a look for Chief Gassoy's article in the November issue of the Firehouse magazine. And, Rich, we'll see you again next month. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks to all the listeners.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening. And stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.